Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll first go to New Delhi, India, and speak with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, the Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University, and discuss the apparent political paralysis in India, where the politicians in charge do not seem to have any idea of what went wrong and why, when hundreds of millions of citizens lost power for days. Then we will speak with Miriam Golden, the Vice Chair of Graduate Studies in the Department of Political Science at UCLA. She is just back from India, where she has been studying the power grid in India's largest state and was there during the blackouts. Then we'll look into the Tea Party victory in Texas, where an ex-CIA officer and extremely conservative Republican lieutenant governor running for the United States Senate was defeated by a conservative extremist who was promoted by Sarah Palin, Glenn Beck, and Sean Hannity, and lavishly supported with outside money from Grover Norquist, Dick Armey, and the Koch brothers. Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, joins us to discuss whether the further purging of the GOP establishment gives Democrats an opening with rejected refugees from the Republican Party. Then finally, we will pay tribute to Gore Vidal, who passed away yesterday in Los Angeles at the age of 86. Over the decades, the Pacifica Archives have captured Gore Vidal's acerbic critiques of the life and times of the American Republic as it struggles to survive the American Empire. And we will play some excerpts of his speeches and interviews. Joining us now from New Delhi is Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. His books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, and India Since 1980. And his latest book, just out, co-author with Espal Kapoor, is India, Pakistan and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia, Contemporary Asia and in the World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
Thank you.
So you're in New Delhi. You've had 2 days of power outages, obviously not as bad as in the rest of the country, particularly in the north and the east. What's happening today? Was there power today in New Delhi?
In vast sections of New Delhi, power has been restored and life is resuming a sense of normalcy, though there is an enormous sense of anger and frustration amongst the citizenry, a sense that they have been seriously let down. And this happened at a time when the weather was had been pretty miserable, and only the last few days, fortunately, when actually the power did go out, there had been a little bit of a respite because of the rains. But there is a widespread sense of anger and frustration with what has transpired.
So does this call into question India's superpower ambitions? In other words, often India and China are considered the rising powers in the world, but the vision of India as a superpower in the future has taken a pretty bad hit, hasn't it?
It has certainly taken a very bad hit, but one has to bear in mind that unlike in China, where various matters, perhaps not of this magnitude, but various matters can actually be hushed up, they cannot be hushed up in India. In India, everything is available for people to examine and scrutinize, warts and all. And obviously, in the days and weeks ahead, this issue will be front and center in Indian political debates and available for the entire world to read. But yes, at one level it does, I'm afraid, cast aspersions about India's imminent rise as a great power.
Well, in the midst of this power outage, the Minister for Power was essentially promoted to Home Minister. Now, that's pretty extraordinary, and I take it the kind of vigorous press in India must be all over that story.
They have been acerbic in their criticisms of what has transpired, and it also reveals the lack of the depth of the bench in the Congress Party, that there just is such a paucity of people that they could probably turn to, that they fell back on a sort of a member of the cabinet who had clearly demonstrated that he's utterly inept. And even though what appalled me no end was that in an interview with a major Indian national television channel, he actually had the temerity to say, "I've done an excellent job as the power minister." I mean, it's as if the man is impervious to what's going on around him.
So what is the explanation then for the Congress Party, which has been in power for most of India's democracy, and of course essentially one family, the Gandhi family, have dominated, and now the widow, who's not even Indian, is a powerful figure apparently. Is this just a case of what happens with entrenched parties like the PRI in Mexico after 70 years finally collapsed through its own kind of corruption? The Liberal Democratic Party in Japan has the same similar problem. What is the explanation for what you're considering the ineptitude of the party and its lack of depth in terms of its bench of politicians?
There's little question that the party has been entrenched in Indian politics for a very long time, and as a consequence, there's a certain sclerosis in the political party. But beyond that, one shouldn't simply blame Congress. One also has to take into account the propensity of other politicians who have engaged in similar populist practices as providing cheap or virtually free power to farmers and other agricultural constituencies, and have simply ignored hard budget constraints and have simply raided the exchequer as needed. And also the failure of regulatory mechanisms in India, which should have much greater teeth, and the rampant political interference in state electricity boards, which are responsible for the transmission of power, where bureaucrats come under considerable pressure from politicians, regardless of ideological persuasion. And unfortunately, the whole discussion about what might be done is simply calls for greater state involvement. That instead of saying that, look, the state's involvement in the generation and distribution of power has been abysmal, it's time to privatize power. But instead of suggesting that, the suggestion is, well, all we need is better regulation, greater sort of scrutiny, greater surveillance. All of those things might be ameliorative. But the fundamental problem remains that unless power is priced at a level where it generates enough revenue, you will never be able to invest in new plant and equipment. You will not be able to modernize your transmission capabilities, and you will not also be able to deal with the problem of theft. A private power company will take theft much more seriously because they are beholden to stockholders. And I'm afraid similar kinds of controls don't exist on public power companies, and hence there is a profligate theft of power in India.
So what about India's emerging business community? And we hear all about the high-tech boom in India and the call centers proliferating, etc. Obviously, they all operate on power. I know most people, and I assume big businesses, have backup generators. But you would think that the business community would be weighing in, because according to the government's own study, the power failures cost India's growth rate about 1.2% a year.
You know, basically, what a lot of industries have done have set up what are referred to as captive power plants, which are power plants which are solely dedicated to meeting their own needs, because they simply cannot afford to be reliant upon the grid. But this form of opting out has perverse consequences, because then the operators of the grid feel, well, why should we work up a sweat? These people are off the grid anyway. It's of no great consequence to us if we don't supply them with steady, uninterrupted, reliable power. And this is a real tragedy, but basically what a lot of businesses have discovered, small and large, is that because they cannot rely on the grid, they have either generators if they are small businesses or have captive power plants if they are more significant, larger-sized businesses. And as a result, the incentive to respond to their needs has declined even further. And it thereby you create a rather vicious spiral.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly in New Delhi. Apparently, India is making an effort to build more generating plants, but I believe a lot of them are coal-fired, which, of course, will add to global warming. What's the state of the green movement in India? Because I saw a map a while back that showed India at the turn of the century and then through the 20s, 30s, 40s up to the present in terms of how much of the country was covered by forests. And it's a shocking deforestation. It's quite amazing.
It is. And that comes after significant reforestation and afforestation efforts, which in part actually have been successful. So imagine if those efforts had not been underway and if they hadn't met with a modicum of success. Things would be even more dire than the map that you saw. So yes, indeed, coal-fired plants do contribute to the hydrocarbons in the atmosphere. But given that India has substantial deposits of coal, there has been a propensity to open up further coal-fired plants.
Well, what about green energy, though? We've talked about coal-powered plants being built to make up for the deficiency in the demand, and we haven't talked about how to fix the grid. It sounds like that's a monstrous problem in itself. And nuclear power, but no wind, no solar, that's not in the menu?
No, that's not true. There are certain Indian firms that actually are at the forefront of wind energy. There's a firm called Suzlon, S-U-Z-L-O-N, which has not only created wind farms in this country, but has also tried to sell the technology abroad. So there are incipient efforts underway. Solar energy is actually quite plentiful in this country, but its potential really has not been tapped. In part, it has to do with the costs of solar cells and solar collectors. There's an initial gestation cost. And also, I think there is a tendency to emulate other states that, you know, if solar energy is so terribly attractive, why haven't the advanced industrial states made greater investments there? I think there's a certain kind of emulative tendencies that exist. And unless there's a kind of a proven success of solar energy elsewhere, there's a certain hesitation on the part of Indian policymakers to go down that route, even though more thoughtful advocates in Indian civil society have been pushing for a more aggressive approach to solar energy.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today from New Delhi, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. His books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, India Since 1980, and his latest book just out is India, Pakistan and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia.